Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
That is completely un-American for you to say that a family crossover should not have 375 horsepower and be able to go 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds. Completely unacceptable. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin, senior reporter at Inside EVs. We've got a lot to dig into this week, including more unfortunate news about the EV tax credit, a new low-cost battery chemistry from GM, and a bunch of new EVs from Toyota. Patrick has abandoned us again, so joining me this week is my colleague, Suvrath Kattari. How's it going, man?
Hi, Tim. Good to be back on the podcast. Thanks for having me. I feel like New York City is on fire right now. That's because of basketball. The Knicks are just one game away from reaching the Eastern Conference finals in the NBA playoffs, which I think has not happened in years, if not decades. So I think I'm pumped, and so is the city really. Everywhere I'm seeing folks wearing Jalen Brunson t-shirts and screening the games in restaurants and bars. So good times. What's up with you?
I had no idea you were a basketball fan.
I am. I am a huge basketball fan. I don't support one team specifically, but right now I'm just being opportunistic and just supporting the Knicks because I'm here.
Now I know why you have a hard 6 p.m. out in an hour. Is that why?
No, that's not why, but that could be a reason, yeah.
That is part of it.
I see why you feel suspect.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I'm good. I just got back from Savannah, Georgia. I was driving the new Hyundai Ioniq 9. And more importantly, honestly, the reason I kind of took that trip was to go see the Meta plant, the enormous new factory outside Savannah that's going to be making Hyundais and Kias and Genesis cars. And it was super cool. It like truly lived up to expectations.
Wow.
Unlike any car plant I've ever seen. And I've been to a few, and this one had like these robots just everywhere. These like autonomous little platforms of like different sizes, all like going around doing different jobs, taking like car parts from here to there, taking whole cars like from the end of one line to the beginning of the next. It was crazy. It was really cool. I recommend going there if you can.
Did you end up seeing that Boston Dynamics robot doing quality inspection checks?
This was extremely disappointing. I saw, so we were taken on like golf carts through the factory, which was awesome. Like it was very cool. I kind of wish I could have like spent more time. I could have spent the whole day like walking around there. But we were taken around on golf carts, and at a certain point, like partially completed bodies come off of this line on one of those platforms. It like rolls into this spot where the Boston Dynamics dogs, which Hyundai owns Boston Dynamics, like do a quality inspection. Anyway, they didn't move at all. Like I don't know if they did anything, but like the car went in between them, and they're supposed to like do like a little like crab walk and like sniff around the car and see if there's anything wrong. They did no such thing. They were just standing there. I think maybe they just put them there for the journalist to look at.
Maybe.
To my knowledge, they
just for sure.
Yeah. Maybe. But it was super cool. And Savannah was really nice. Like I want to go back there on my free time.
I've heard that those Hyundai plants have like really changed the landscape of those small Georgia towns. Savannah, Bryan County, and there are a lot more actually. So yeah, good for Georgia.
Yeah, probably. They're not fully like ramped up yet. It was, they weren't exactly like spitting out cars super fast, but they are eventually gonna employ a lot of people. Yeah, I think it'll probably be great for that area.
Absolutely.
Okay. Should we get into the news? I know you actually had your own little trip recently. You went to GM's Battery Development Center in Michigan, and you learned about an interesting new type of battery that GM is working on. Tell me a little bit about, tell me a little bit about what's it like visiting this battery facility, because that sounds super cool. And then we can talk about what exactly this new battery that they're developing is.
Right. So I did not really know what to expect going into this trip to Michigan. So GM invited us to check out their battery R&D facilities outside of Detroit. So we know that China is, you know, leaps and bounds ahead in terms of batteries. So expecting that from an American automaker, I had my doubts. But, you know, as a serious and honest and impartial journalist, I tried to keep an open mind. And I was extremely impressed with what I saw. So the R&D facility is called the General Motors Technical Center. And within that campus, there are like multiple buildings where they do R&D for like propulsion and battery systems. But just like fun fact before we dive into the battery stuff, I found that the $340,000 Cadillac Celestiq, which is this super luxurious EV that GM has on sale now, that's fully made at that R&D facility. It's not made at a manufacturing plant anywhere. It's made at this technical center. It's where they invite all these high-profile VIP customers to come in and custom make the interiors of the Celestiq.
Interesting. That's cool. Yeah, the Celestiq is like it's kind of like, for whatever reason, Cadillac has decided that they can make that they want to make like a Rolls Royce, like Bentley kind of competitor EV, and that's what the Celestiq is. Like super low volume, all handmade. And yeah, so I guess in a way it makes sense. They don't like make it at a factory. They just make it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Did you see them? Did you see one or multiple?
I did see, there were a bunch of them parked around, and I also saw them like drive around in loops. They do look very stately, I have to say. That shape itself, I'm not a big fan of, which is like, you know, this fastback sort of broad and big sedan with a long wheelbase and it's like super low, but it did look like striking. I could not ignore it. But let's talk about batteries, because that's why I was really there.
Yeah.
So GM has two main R&D facilities in Michigan. The first one is called the Kettering R&D Center, and the other one is called the Wallace Battery Innovation Center. So the Kettering Center is where they basically do the very like initial levels of research. So they make everything from a small coin cell, which is literally like as small as the button of my t-shirt. And from there, they go on to make like automotive grade batteries. So it's a big process. And they have this very fancy equipment, really high tech. So everything from electrolyte development to cathode synthesis and failure analysis. It was like a chemistry lesson. I mean, there's a reason why I left science after school to attend an arts college. But I feel like science never really left me. I was back in the labs this time. So it was very cool to see GM has come far along in the development of these new cells than we think.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Wait, so they start with, like, when they're developing new chemistries, they just like start with a super tiny cell and then like work their way up to like the kind that's, you know, whatever, a few inches tall and will actually go into a car.
Right. That's exactly what that is. Think of battery development like a recipe, like a food recipe. First, once you get the recipe right, then you have to focus on scaling. And scaling is where the technology lies. Like you can create any recipe you want, but the real challenge is to make it across big surfaces in big plants and like reduce the number of defects that happen across those plants. So yeah, it goes right from a small coin cell to your regular 2170 or 4680 that Tesla makes, but really starts on the small level.
Cool. So what is this new, I think it's LMR battery, and And why does it matter? Like, what is new about this for GM or for the EV world?
Right. So LMR stands for lithium manganese rich. That's a relatively new chemistry. It's been around for decades, but GM has been working on for it for about 10 years now, and they really started doing the development for it at an accelerated pace from 2020 onwards. So when we're talking about LMR or NMC or LFP, these are basically what's called as cathode active material, or CAM, as they're known in the battery world, because the anode side of the battery, which is where your charge deposits, when a vehicle battery is fully charged, all those active particles go to the anode side. And anode is usually just graphite. Nowadays, they're mixing a little bit of silicon in the anode. But the real magic happens on the cathode side. And NMC and LFP are basically cathode active materials. The problem with NMC is that cobalt is the most expensive and dirty material in a battery, which is why nowadays we have what's called as a high nickel battery, where the level of cobalt is lower and nickel content is increased. And that's all done in the interests of costs. And I'm sure you've heard cobalt has all sorts of problems, right? It's a byproduct of copper. Copper mining is problematic. We've seen like labor violations across the world really happening. So manufacturers are trying to come clean now and reduce their reliance on cobalt. Mm-hmm. But nickel is not all that clean either. It's also extremely expensive. Most of it is mined in Indonesia. Most of it is processed in China, as everything is when it comes to batteries these days.
Right.
So GM's solution is now to what's the next step when it comes to their cost reduction strategy? So GM thinks they can also reduce the level of nickel and really increase the level of manganese. That's how you get what's called a lithium manganese battery. It's essentially an NMC battery, but far lower contents of nickel, far lower contents of cobalt, but a lot of manganese.
Okay.
I'll tell you a bunch of reasons why they think this is going to work. There's obviously reasons for caution, because this is something we have not seen on the roads yet. But according to GM, manganese is abundant on Earth's crust. The supply chain can be localized. So GM in 2023 partnered with this company called Element 25, which is a manganese supplier. And Element 25 is going to make a facility in Louisiana where they're going to process this manganese. But at the time when they made this announcement back in 2023, Element 25 said that we're going to source manganese from Australia. So it's not like completely localized in the US, mm-hmm. but it's better than China, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, what the people need to know is, like, there's a couple of chemistries that are basically the most popular. Like you mentioned, NMC is nickel manganese cobalt, LFP is lithium iron phosphate, and the kind of, like, it seems like the battery industry is moving toward, like, how do we source materials for these cathodes, right? We're talking cathodes, yeah.
Cathodes, yeah.
How do we source materials for these cathodes that are, like, easier to find, easier to mine, cheaper, still work like just as well as the kind of traditional NMC one, and also are like more separated from China, like things that we can source from the US or from like US allies. So in that way, it makes a lot of sense. And I think part of it was the cost of it, right? Because like, so LFP is a cheaper battery chemistry, and for that reason, it's really taking off around the world. But it's also, like, of all of them, I think maybe most centralized in China. Like, you can't get lithium iron phosphate basically to make your batteries without getting it or some part of it from China. So it's cool if this can like lower the cost of
yep.
of a battery and of an EV, which is like the, you know, so much happens once you can lower the cost of that battery, because it's just like the most expensive part of an EV, right? You're talking about in some of these big GM trucks, it's like, I don't know, I mean I'm ballparking here, but $20,000 maybe for that battery, maybe more. So anything you can do to bring that cost down, I think will be great for consumers.
Yeah, I do want to point out, so since you mentioned the Hummer EV, I did see the battery pack of the Hummer EV at the Wallace Research Center. So that thing was insane. I've never seen anything like it before. It was the size.
Did it have a gravitational pull? Were you like trying to not magnetized to it?
Yeah, I would say it did have a gravitational pull on me. It was basically the size of a full king size mattress. It's a huge, huge battery. And the weight of it was about 3,000 pounds, which, by the way, the BYD Seagull EV, which is like a tiny EV in China, extremely popular. It's basically making the whole world go electric apart from the US. The Seagull EV weighs less than that Hummer EV battery. So it's just insane. I don't know how they're making it work in terms of chassis dynamics and all that, but it's basically two layers of modules stacked on top of the other, which is why it makes it so big. So one layer of module has like 12 module units in them, and then each module has individual battery cells. So like two of them stacked on top of the
it's like two battery packs stacked on top of each other, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So now GM thinks to solve that issue, the lithium manganese rich battery, which are fitted in basically in the prismatic cell format, right? So prismatic cells are basically square or rectangular shaped cells, which can really neatly stack together. They can basically be stacked like small boxes next to each other in a big battery box. So GM thinks that philosophy is really going to help them solve this problem, especially for big SUVs and trucks. So I'll just go through some ballpark numbers that GM shared with us for the lithium manganese rich prismatic cells. So GM says LMR cells will have 33% more energy density compared to LFP, that too at comparable costs. The Silverado EV is going to get an LFP battery now. And on that, they're saying the cost will reduce by about $6,000, which I think is not a lot, but it's not nothing either. For EVs, I think if you stack, say, the federal tax credit, which I know we're going to talk about later, and plus these cost savings, I think costs could come down significantly. Production.
Wait, the Silverado EV is getting LFP or LMR?
Silverado is getting LFP, but they're saying the cost savings will be comparable with LMR also. They have not shared with us which truck or SUV will get LMR. But I suspect it'll either be the Silverado or the Sierra, because they had these pictures of those trucks. And they really said that it's really for trucks and full-size SUVs. So production is expected to begin in 2028 on an electric truck. And we'll see how it goes. I'm a little bit skeptical, but I'm also cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, no, it's super cool. I think one of the things that sticks out to me there is you said that GM says LMR will be 33% more energy dense than LFP at a comparable cost, which is so the big kind of unlock of LFP is that it's cheaper and the materials are kind of more abundant, but also you take a hit to energy density. That's like the problem with it. Right. It's like you can make a pretty cheap, a much cheaper EV battery, but like per volume or per kilogram of battery, it's not going to be able to like hold as much energy or give as much range as one of those more expensive and more energy dense NMC batteries. So the idea that they can get to good cost, like LFP like cost with greater energy density and range, that's pretty cool. I think that is a big step forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. So the Silverado EV with the LFP battery is estimated to get around 350 miles of range. And the LMR battery, GM says, without mentioning which vehicle will get it, it's going to get more than 400 miles of range. And that's estimates
that makes sense
on the EPA cycle. So the 33% thing definitely makes sense. And if they can price it at comparable levels, then I think that's a big win for the overall economics of big and heavy trucks and SUVs. Because that's the other thing about LMR prismatic cells is that they're going to reduce costs. They're going to reduce pack level weight significantly because these prismatic cells, they're really easy to stack. So you require lower structural bracing, and that structural bracing is what really adds on to the weight of these battery packs. I mean, if you look at the Hummer EV's battery pack, it has 24 modules, and every single module has its own wall. It has its own cooling system. It has its own structure. And if you get rid of all of that, you're reducing a lot of weight. So I think GM is being smart about this. And really, even Ford is actually working on LMR. And one thing a Ford engineer told me this week was that LMR is going to be the LFP of the Western Hemisphere, which is really bold.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. If it's materials that are more easy to get here, then yeah, could be. Last thing I'll say, I think we should move on. But I think it's kind of one of those moments where you realize just how early everything is in EVs. Like, modern EVs have really only been around for, 10 years, 15 years. And so the technology is just moving forward in really interesting ways. Like, combustion engines, transmissions, all that has been basically like capped out at, for decades. And this is like, we're still, the industry is still trying to figure out like, what's the best chemistry for this particular type of vehicle. They're still working on like new motors and inverters and all this technology. So it's really cool to see that it's, still progressing, right?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we're all growing and learning together, not just journalists, but I think the whole engineer and scientific community is also, for them also, it's like a new language and they're also still learning. But EV batteries are not the biggest news of the week, right, Tim? What else do we have cooking?
Protect your boats and recreational vehicles with FPP RV and Marine Antifreeze. It has burst-proof protection down to negative 50 degrees, keeping you protected against freezing temperatures. Keep your winter worry-free with FPP ready-to-use RV and Marine Antifreeze now at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com and shop our great selection of automotive products. Save big money at
Menards. Yeah, Toyota gave the lowdown on three new EVs this week. There is a new refreshed bZ4X, which has been its sole EV, and now there's also a couple of new ones that we'll talk about after that. But first, what's new in the bZ4X? I think the best part about it is that they changed that horrible name. Now it's just the bZ, and so yeah, a lot less of a mouthful, kind of made you wonder before, like, whether they were actually trying to sell these things with that name, but now it's just the bZ.
Yeah, I mean, right after I wrote the bZ4X story, a lot of people have commented that bZ4X owners already call it the bZ because I guess it's too painful to call it bZ4X every single time. So I guess Toyota was like, yeah, we hear you. So I'm happy we're done with that dumb alphanumeric name. Yeah, but yeah, like apart from that,
it's kind of like they took all the complaints that people have had about the bZ4X since it came out a couple of years ago and we're like, all right, we're just gonna go, like, we've heard enough, like, please shut up, people. We're gonna go down this list and be like, okay, name's annoying, more range, all that stuff. So yeah, what else did they do to the bZ4X?
Yeah, I think we are part of that community who has been like screeching and screaming to improve the bZ4X. But yeah, so the biggest news is a lot more range, 25% more range on the bZ now. So the top front wheel drive trims will get up to 314 miles. That's thanks to a bigger 74.7 kilowatt hour battery that they have now. And they're doing this a lot like Hyundai does with the IONIQ 5. It offers a smaller battery pack and a bigger one for those who need that extra range. So there's also a smaller 54 kilowatt hour battery pack on the entry level bZ now. The charging speed is interestingly still the same. So it's capped out at 150 kilowatts. But I think they're going to improve the charging curve. And they've done a lot in terms of the EV powertrain. So it has battery preconditioning now, which basically helps your battery to get to the correct temperature before you begin charging. And that really improves the efficiency and speed of charging. And they also now have a heat pump, which I think should be standard at this point in America. Not all EVs have those yet. But a heat pump is basically another device in your EV, which really helps manage the thermal efficiency of your vehicle and optimizes your charging speed, your range in colder climates.
Yeah, and it's a much more efficient way of heating the vehicle, right? Like heating the cabin of the vehicle is my understanding. The problem with EVs, and I experienced this when I road tripped the old Toyota BZ4X when it was really cold out, is like, if you're heating your cabin, you're just taking a ton of energy from the battery, unlike in a combustion car where the engine is just generating heat. And then when you turn the heat on, it just blows it into the cabin. So a heat pump helps a lot with heating yourself without sacrificing too much range.
Correct. There are also some other changes. So it has slightly sharper looks now, which are obviously not big differences, but I think it makes a big impact on how the BZ4X looks. But there's more to the new BZ. I keep saying it BZ4X because it's just so ingrained in my brain right now. The new BZ also gets a new trim now.
Yeah, it's kind of like just textbook basic EV stuff that they probably should have done to this car from the very beginning, right? Like the complaint was always it had like the starting range was like 220 something miles of range.
Yeah.
Max was like 250-ish. Now it's up to 314 miles of range, like real like big boy range numbers that people will actually be happy with. But that's not all. There is another BZ, which I think the name of this one is not great in my opinion. The BZ Woodland, which kind of so this is like the Toyota version. This is like a lifted wagon type thing. It is the Toyota version of the Subaru Trail Seeker, which was revealed recently. Subaru and Toyota jointly develop these EVs. And so you have the BZ4X and the Subaru Solterra, which are basically like cousins of each other. And now we have a new one, which is the Subaru Trail Seeker and the BZ Woodland. And I feel like the Trail Seeker got like the way better, way more badass name. But this is a sort of off-road-ish rugged wagon.
Right, yeah. I don't know what they were thinking about the Woodland name. The Trail Seeker is definitely a cooler name. So, but they're basically twins, and they wear different clothes. That's what this is. So the BZ Woodland is just like an electric Subaru Outback, just like the Trail Seeker. So it gets a bunch of off-road chops that includes standard all-wheel drive. The motors are upgraded. So just like the BZ, it also gets these silicon carbide semiconductors in the electric motors, which apparently make the car a lot faster and more efficient. And speaking of a faster EV, this one gets 375 horsepower. Which I think is absolutely ridiculous when you think of the audience, right? Like these are just regular families who might be a little bit like adventurous, and these are regular EVs.
I'm gonna play the role of Patrick right now and say, Suvrat, that is completely un-American for you to say that a family crossover should not have 375 horsepower and be able to go 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds, completely unacceptable. That is what everybody should have.
Right. I agree, actually. Adventure is better when it's shared, right? So I think everybody should get like fast EVs and wagons and SUVs. But yeah, so this one can do 0 to 60 miles per hour in 4.5 seconds. And that should absolutely very easily smoke the GR86, which is the gas-powered small sports car Toyota has. And this comes within half a second of the Supra, which I think is pretty impressive. So apart from the performance advantages, the BZ Woodland also has lots of off-road chops. So that includes an additional inch of ground clearance. So now the ground clearance is 8.3 inches. It is 6 inches longer, and much of that extra length is in the rear overhang. So it has more space for cargo. So your camping gear, your surfboards, your tents, all of that should fit really neatly inside. And it also has some design changes. You get off-road rugged body cladding or all around. You have roof rails. So yeah, really neat job from Toyota. We'll see how this actually looks on the road. But there's also another model that they have that we're going to talk about, right, Tim?
Yeah. Yeah, so you mean when you say 6 inches longer, 6 inches longer, it's like a stretched BZ4X where they just, instead of putting like more seats or something, they just like stretch the cargo area. So it's like a wagon. Right. Yeah, and then there's the other one. The last one is a new EV called the CHR, which, if you'll remember, that used to be a gas-powered kind of small, like subcompact Toyota crossover. Now that name is coming back as a smaller than the BZ electric crossover with 338 horsepower, 290 miles of range. That is pretty solid specs all around. And by the way, all of these have the Tesla-style NACS port, the kind of new charging standard. So you'll be able to use these at Tesla superchargers everywhere, which is another really cool touch here. I think the kind of bottom line is like, and we talked about this, so like people who listen to the show, you may remember we talked about this a couple months ago. Patrick saw, he like previewed a bunch of new Toyota EVs. We weren't sure exactly what was going to come to the US and what specs it would have. Now that's basically all this stuff is actually being announced for the US. And I think what's cool is that Toyota kind of has been dragged kicking and screaming into EVs. They have lobbied against pro EV policies. They've been really stuck in the mud about hybrids and plug-in hybrids being the real answer to like reducing emissions around the world. Makes perfect sense. They are the absolute undisputed king of hybrids. So like they want that to be the future.
Yep.
Although all along they have been developing EVs, and now we're starting to see finally like Toyota really kind of get in the game here, right? Like it used to have just the BZ4X, this like pretty lackluster EV that for some reason just cab drivers in New York City bought. And now they're like upping their game with a bunch of, you know, not just a new BZ4X, but a bunch of new models, which is really cool to see, because I think the important thing is like Toyota's the biggest car company by sales in the world. They have been largely sitting this out, and they've also been the company that everybody wants an EV from. Like you look at these surveys and they ask people, car buyers, like, who would you trust to buy your next electric car from? And for years, it's been like Toyota at the top, like above Tesla. Yeah. Because people just think Toyotas are reliable. They like them. They already drive a Camry or a RAV4. And like, they're not going to go buy a Model Y, a Tesla Model Y, or like a Cadillac or whatever. Like they want their Toyota because that's what they've been driving and that's what they like. So I think Toyota's probably going to do pretty well here. I think they're going to start to clean up once all these new cars start hitting the road.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you on that. Believe it or not, but Toyota sold more than 18,000 units of the current BZ4X, which is like a half-assed, lackluster EV, no range, like very low range, not that many features. And Subaru sold 12 to 13,000 Solteras, which is basically the same as the BZ4X, but with a different design. So those are serious numbers. And Toyota, I think, really saw the opportunity here to scale up and clean their act. Of course, it's not up there, say, with the Model Y or something, but I see these BZ4Xs and Solteras everywhere. I don't know about California, but in New York, they're literally everywhere. In fact, I took a ride in the BZ4X from JFK last week, and I asked the driver what he thought about it. You know, it was my first time riding in a BZ4X, really. And he was like, he loves the car, but he would like more range and faster charging and more charging options also, which is a separate issue, obviously. So I think a lot of these New York City cabbies have gone ahead and bought these cars because they know the brand and they trust the brand. And also a lot of private owners will now be interested in the new BZ and the BZ Woodland and the CHR because these are really a bunch of new options in the hot, in the super hot electric crossover market.
Yeah, I heard you say BZ Woodland again. And I was like, God, what a... I'm like, sorry, Toyota, but that is not a good name. It just like, it just calls to mind like, you know, like fairies or something, like a fairy tale. It doesn't sound like the kind of badass, like rugged off-road.
They should have stuck with the other off-road names that they have for their gas cars, like the TRD Pro or the Trail Hunter. They have like a Tacoma Trail Hunter. That would have been cool.
Yeah, like the Subaru's got like the Outback Wilderness and stuff like that, and Toyota has the BZ Woodland. we'll see how that works out. It looks cool. Name not so much. Okay, let's move on from Toyota. So last week we talked about how Congress was likely going to kill the EV tax credit. That's what House Speaker Mike Johnson said. Now we know a little bit more about what that plan may actually look like. The House Ways and Means Committee advanced a proposal to end basically all of the clean energy related tax credits that were created by the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's not looking good for EVs. This is just a draft, or I guess at this point it's not a draft, but this is an early stage of the legislation. This is not law yet. It still needs to go through the budget reconciliation process to actually be part of the, you know, quote unquote, big, beautiful bill that Donald Trump wants. But as of now, based on the words of this proposal, Congress is on track to cut the $4,000 incentive for used EVs and the credit for commercial EVs after December 31st. And then the $7,500 rebate for new EVs, which is kind of like the main credit that everybody knows and has been around for a long time, that is going to live on for another year, through the end of 2026, but in a severely restricted way that we'll talk about in a sec. But I guess, what are your thoughts here, just right off the bat?
Yeah, I feel a little upset because of the fact that they're trying to cut the used EV incentive also, because the used EV market, I think, is the entry point for a lot of people who do find EVs, which are so expensive compared to gas cars. But now their entry point itself is sort of strangulated now. But overall, I think, you know, change is hard to accept and it's part of human nature, and it will definitely cause harm to the broader auto industry. I mean, over the past year, both of us have been reporting about EVs for a while now. So there's so much data out there about these credits helping create jobs and manufacturing facilities and, you know, helping the automakers sort of soften the blow, because EVs are really capital intensive. But I think the Republicans in the Senate could be against this program, right? At least some of them.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think we'll have to see how it plays out. Like, we could easily see some lawmakers who have these big new facilities in their states coming out against this plan and wanting to save the credits, at least in some way. This is just an early stage of it. But yeah, I agree with you. It's like the thing that I keep thinking about is consistency. And it's like you said, these are really important for defraying those early costs of like ramping up EV production, because it costs a lot. They're really important for building up scale, because they push these EVs to more people, make them more affordable for more people. And like, you have a lot of automakers, a lot of battery companies that have made decisions over the last couple of years, assuming that these credits were going to stay in place. And now they have factories that are announced, factories that are under construction or already built, and they're like, wait a second, the credit that was going to drive huge amounts of demand for EVs and batteries is now going away. Like, what the hell? So it's, yeah, it's going to be really destructive if this plan goes ahead as written right now. The weird thing is that, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the changes to the regular clean car tax credit, 30D, if you're a nerd and you care about what exact part of the tax code it is. So like I said, it's going to extend through 2026, but only for companies that have sold fewer than 200,000 EVs since 2009. And so that might sound familiar because that's actually how the credit used to work. Like before it was overhauled by the Inflation Reduction Act, manufacturers used to cap out at 200,000 units. Once you sold 200,000 EVs, your $7,500 credit started phasing out. And so manufacturers like Tesla, GM, under the old rules, their cars couldn't get tax credits anymore. The weird thing is that this directly disadvantages U.S. car companies, which seems completely at odds with the whole Trump administration's, you know, goal of like pretty much only prioritizing U.S. companies at the expense of, well, at the expense of everybody. But like this doesn't make a lot of sense given that this is like the tariff president. So, you know, which automakers have sold more than 200,000 cars? That includes Tesla, Ford, Stellantis, and GM, all the U.S. or like U.S. adjacent car companies, right? They would not qualify. Some others that have sold more than 200,000, Hyundai, Nissan, Toyota, and BMW. So there's a lot that fall under the cap still. Rivian, Mercedes, Audi, Honda, a bunch of others. But those U.S. companies are just not going to benefit from this for the next year.
Yeah, it sounds like the companies that are really trying to drive this shift, especially in the mass market, are going to be affected. I mean, not that Rivian and Audi and Honda are not doing a good job, but like we need GM and Tesla to continue selling more EVs in this country, but that's not happening right now. I hope they're not going after the manufacturing credit, but it sounds like they are. So 45X and 48C, again, those are the tax codes for the nerds, which support the federal incentives for the production facilities themselves and also the critical materials. I mean, there was an interesting stat I read a few days ago about the how these dollars work. So for every $1 of federal incentives that the state of Georgia was getting, there was $4.5 of private investment that was also happening. So the tax credits, in a way, are also sort of a catalyst for organic growth. But looks like all of this is just going to get hammered now.
Yeah. I have bad news for you. A lot of automakers, I think this is the one that people kind of assumed was going to stick around, is 45X, the manufacturing credit that subsidizes production of things like solar, wind turbines, but also battery cells and battery modules. So this was a big deal. This is a big deal for automakers and for bringing down the input costs of making EVs. And that one was not totally terminated like the EV tax credits, but they're sunsetting it. They're proposing to sunset it earlier. They're adding a bunch of restrictions to it that, as far as I understand, will make it a lot less effective. But the last thing I wanted to mention was the commercial credit. So this is the one that is also known as the leasing loophole. So basically, like, the regular purchase credit has all these restrictions around it. Your batteries need to be your batteries can't have any material from China. The cars need to be made in North America. If you buy one, you have to make under a certain income. There are price caps on these cars. It's all basically designed to support manufacturing and EV supply chains that are like centered around the US and North America. If you lease a car, you can get that credit without following any of those criteria, without meeting any of those restrictions. And so what it means is that leasing has just gone absolutely off the wall over the last couple of years. And I have a feeling that if that commercial credit goes away and leasing EVs becomes a lot less advantageous, like that is going to have an enormous impact on EV sales, which is a really big bummer because there has been a lot of momentum in this industry for the last few years. You know, every year it's been record EV sales, 1.3 million last year, a lot of those leased. Right. And so I've been looking into that and I found some pretty shocking stats. Like I knew that EV leases were getting really popular, but I kind of didn't realize exactly how much. So in 2022, which is basically pre-IRA, about 11.5% of EVs sold were leased. In 2024, that was around 45%. So about half of EVs sold last year were leases, in large part because of this kind of credit, this the wrinkle in the law. And then in February, which is the most recent data I could find from Cox Automotive, around 60%, a little over 60% of EVs sold were leases. So that commercial credit goes away, like, I think that it's going to be really bad for the numbers throughout. Well, I think if that leasing credit goes away, it's going to be really bad long term. I think this year, like through December 31st, we might have the best year for EV sales ever. Like as everybody rushes to go and pick up their new lease or purchase. But after that, it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah, so we're seeing that pattern already happen. Like the first quarter of this year, we saw a lot of these Hyundais and Kias being picked up. But that also explains why automakers all this while the tax credits existed, they were going crazy with the lease deals, right? So Inside EVs maintains a comprehensive lease offers and finance offers list on its website. If you're gonna lease or finance EVs, you should definitely check that out. So Hyundai, Toyota, Polestar, Nissan, they basically have been going crazy with these lease deals. You can grab one for as low as $150 a month for a bZ4X. If you want an Ioniq 5, that's also in that similar range for the base model. Now, obviously, the fees will stack on top, the acquisition fees and the destination and all of that. But these are still incredible deals and people have been taking advantage of them. So I think, like what you said, they're trying to hit right where it hurts, you know, like capping off the scalability these manufacturers, Tesla, GM, have really started to achieve. But now I think we are in reverse mode.
Yeah, for sure. It's it would be really unfortunate to see, or really unfortunate for this industry. I think, you know, the IRA, like the important thing to mention is that it created this kind of very comprehensive policy framework. Like that's what I hear from experts in this space is like, it's not one thing, right? It's not just subsidizing like people who want to buy the car. It's also subsidizing production. It's subsidizing moving production to the US and North America. And so it kind of created this whole system of like building up this industry, building up EV sales, making America more competitive with the rest of the world, with like China, who has spared no expense to build up their industry. And now it's like, who knows what happens next? If all this goes away, a lot of these factories, I suspect, are gonna, you know, either not get built or move to make hybrids and gas cars instead of maybe making as many EVs. I think we could see a lot of battery factories straight up not get built. I mentioned last week this analysis from Princeton professor Jesse Jenkins of the Repeat Project, and he estimates that if the EV tax credits and the tailpipe emissions regulations go away, we won't need any more battery facilities in the US on top of the ones that are currently operational, because there just won't be that demand for EVs, which creates the demand for the batteries. It would just like stunt the US battery industry, which has been growing like crazy, or like at least projected to grow like crazy. Right. So yeah, all around pretty destructive for this industry. But I think it's important to mention that like everybody that I talk to says that EVs will continue to grow. Like the industry will continue to grow without these incentives. You know, manufacturing in America, manufacturing of these vehicles will continue to grow, but just like not nearly at the pace that it could have, and not nearly as much in America as it could have been with the IRA.
Yeah, you're right. I think folks don't give, especially those in the government and lawmakers who make these decisions, they don't give enough credit to the IRA, which, like you mentioned, it's not just subsidizing the cars, right? They're giving credits across the supply chain, upstream and downstream, to really uplift this whole industry and make America more competitive in this whole technology, right? Because it's not just a race for climate change or selling more EVs. It's about it's a tech race, and we're yeah. lagging behind in that. And in 2023, North America was the fastest growing battery manufacturing region in the whole world. It was growing even faster than China, and that was because of the regulations which were put in place under the IRA by the previous administration. But I guess now we're headed in a completely different direction. But I also do agree that at some point, America would need some organic growth in terms of EVs. But I just wish that happened, like the phasing out of the tax credits was more gradual and not so sudden.
Yeah, we definitely could see that exact thing, right? Like I talked to a Kia executive late last year who was like, yeah, it would be stupid to remove the tax credits, but if you do, at least phase it out gradually over time. So there's going to be a fight over this stuff over the next weeks and months. This isn't all settled yet. We could see exactly that. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see, how this all plays out. Now that we've lost probably half listeners by talking about depressing tax credit policy, it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where yeah. we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world. You are our guest, so you get to go first.
Okay, I think the BZ4X or what is now called the BZ, that's definitely a plus. I'm excited because I'm gonna drive it next week in Texas. So the BZ. The BZ or the CHR, and also the off-road, weirdly named Woodland Edition. I think it's a win because Toyota finally listened to everybody's cries and demands, and we finally have more range, more features. It looks a little bit cooler, more than 300 miles of range. So that's a big plus for this week.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear what you think about that. Yeah, I have a minus, and it is the fact that this was a weird tweet. It was like this week in weird tweets from the Trump administration. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin said, start-stop technology where your car dies at every red light so companies get a climate participation trophy. EPA approved it, and everyone hates it, so we're fixing it. So basically, the head of the EPA wants to fix, quote-unquote, the feature that starts and stops your car every time you stop so you don't idle, which is just like, it feels to me a lot like Trump's obsession with like shower head pressure. It's like, it's like this thing annoys me in particular, so I'm going to build an entire policy around it. I don't know, man. It's like such a weird thing for the EPA to do. First of all, the EPA does not force car companies to do this. They incentivize them to do it by giving them extra emissions credits if they implement this in their cars. And yeah, everybody that I talk to about this is like, oh, thank God, because that is really annoying. I hate that my car does that. But it is also very important. It's kind of a very simple way to curb tailpipe emissions. Like, just don't run yeah. your car when it's not moving. I saw an estimate that feature eliminates nearly 10 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions annually in the U.S.
Wow.
Which feels like a positive thing. Yeah, that sounds yeah. like a lot of tons. So, yeah, That was a weird one. That's a weird one, and that's my minus.
It really blows my mind how they come up with one new thing to attack every now and then, and it's almost every single time it's something extremely trivial like this. But I do think it's a useful feature, especially because, I mean, again, a very New York City perspective. If I'm idling at a red light, I don't want to choke the pedestrians who are walking around me,
yeah.
Especially if I'm in a big truck with four exhaust pipes, which is just belching these nitrous oxide and sulfur and whatnot and all these harmful emissions. I don't want to be part of this crime, to be very honest. So I think this feature is okay, but whatever happens with it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy finally taking a stand against terrible airline food. I think that'll be one I could get behind. All right, man. Thanks so much for joining me this week.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts and send us your questions about the EV world to podcast@insideevs.com. See you next time.